time to take a look at climate and weather with our weather guys. Well, we'll start with one of our weather guys, Steve Ackerman, who is Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So great to have Steve. Great to have you with us again.
It's great to be here. And the end of February, getting ready for March.
Yeah. We'll take a look at the history of the National Weather Service. It was created a long time ago. I want to get into some of the particulars about that. But we'll also take climate and weather questions as well with our two guests. I didn't mention John Martin. He'll be with us probably around the top of the hour as he finishes up the class that he teaches at UW, and he'll be with us. He's, of course, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, of course, a member of that as well. So we'll look at the history of the National Weather Service a bit. We'll maybe get into the Farmer's Almanac, one of John's favorite topics. And we'll look at how a volcanic eruption is affecting Earth's atmosphere. So what do you want to know about the National Weather Service? Do you follow the Farmer's Almanac? Other weather questions or comments or photos, too. We love the weather photos that we get during the show. You can send those via email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Or if you want to call with a question, please do. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Steve, you know, the National Weather Service, I think we have a general idea about what it does, but there are a broad range of things that the National Weather Service is involved in. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, so, I think, you know, we should recognize anyway that most of the weather forecasts that are generated for the U.S. are coming out of the National Weather Service. And, you know, it's interpreted by local folks, or local forecasters take the models, simulations, weather models that the National Weather Service generates, sometimes run their own, but they use the National Weather Service certainly as a resource. And all of the U.S. measurements, temperature measurements, weather measurements are made by the National Weather Service and then freely distributed. And the same thing with the radar. When you're going on a trip or you want to leave home and you want to know if it's raining and you fire up the radar, that's all provided by the National Weather Service and free of charge to the public. And it all began because of a Wisconsinite, Increase Lapham, who is a scientist in Milwaukee, you know, recognized the importance of weather and that it should be nationalized and distributed freely. And he argued for it. The year will eventually come to me when it was actually formed, but it was under President Ulysses Grant.
A long time ago.
Because he's a general. And I think any general that's been to war recognizes the importance of weather. And so he recognized, we need this. And that began the National Weather Service back in the 1870s, I think it was.
Yeah. Wow. Prior to that, what did we do? Were there any sort of weather predictions done prior to creating this weather service?
They didn't have this scientific knowledge at that time. So I think a lot of it was monitoring. If they, had telegraphs and they could, by that time they knew a lot of the weather moved from west to east. And so if there was telegraphs and they were in contact, then they could say what was happening west of you and, assume that that's coming your way, potentially. But there wasn't any real modern type of forecasting, just because the physics wasn't understood at the time.
As somebody was wondering if the National Weather Service is responsible for naming the hurricanes and the winter storms and so forth.
They are. The National Hurricane Center is part of the National Weather Service. And so they do the naming. They do it a couple of years in advance, so you could actually know, this coming hurricane season, which starts in June, you could look up and see what the first hurricane is going to be called, as well as 2 years from now. And then if they cause a lot of damage, then they will retire that name. So there'll never be another Hurricane Andrew, for example. The damage it did, they just, put that name away in honor of the storm and its destructive capabilities.
So do they think, well, let's see, let's name this one after my spouse or somebody? Or I mean, is there a process to that?
There is a... I'll call it folklore in some way because I don't know how true it was, but they use, hurricane names at one point were all women names, and yeah. The theory was that that's how they came up with that naming. I don't know if it's really true. Now we do mix up male, females, as well as Hispanic names as well, so they're not all just European names.
Louise in Dodgeville has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I recently saw some snow total statistics for this season, and it seemed drastically low, compared to last year. So I was wondering if there's a potential drought, getting set up for this coming spring.
Yeah, we are. Snowfalls are really, really low right now. I mean, most of southern Wisconsin, including Dodgeville and us, is like at 20 inches. So we're maybe 50% of what the normal snowfall is. And we are currently in a drought that has sustained through the wintertime, largely because of the lack of snowfall. And so if we don't get a couple of really big snowfalls this spring, which is possible, we're going to be definitely entering a drought in the springtime.
What's the, what is it? Is it 7 inches of snow equals an inch of rain? Or I can't remember the right number on that.
It's, roughly it's the easy number to remember is about 10 inches.
10, okay.
But that's pretty fluffy. And so most of the snowfall we get in Wisconsin is more dense. So it's more like 8 or 9 inches, I think, per inch of liquid water.
Yeah. Louise, thank you so much. Diana and Blair will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Diana.
Hi. I have a NOAA weather radio, and thanks to the Weather Service's long-range forecast back in December 15th, I was reasonably well prepared when my electricity went out. So I just want to give a heads up thank you to the Weather Service.
All right.
Yeah, there was so both John and I were at a atmospheric and oceanic sciences event where we bring together the undergraduates and graduate students, organize it. It's a way to get together and just celebrate. We do this annually. And it happened to be on that day, I'm going to forget the exact date, where we had that snow squall move through Madison. And so it was really funny because, everybody was talking and having a good time, all with our masks on. And then all of a sudden, everybody's phone started giving that NWS weather signal warning. and then the next thing you know, everybody's up at the window looking at the snowfall move through Madison. So, yeah, it's an extremely valuable resource that National Weather Service provides.
That's great. And back to that drought business, there was just a new report on drought in Wisconsin in general. I don't know if you had a chance to look at that, Steve.
No, I haven't seen the report itself, but I do, on a weekly basis, pull up some of the climate maps of where we're at and, what the outlook looks like. And we're definitely in a drought. The outlook for the next month, it doesn't look like a strong indication for increase in snow or precipitation. So I think we're going to go in with a pretty dry, into spring with a pretty dry condition.
At least in southern Wisconsin. I think it's better in the north, is it not?
Yeah, the only place that is above normal is way up northwest, just to the south of Lake Superior. They're up around, 150% of normal snowfall. And I would guess that a lot of that is associated with lake effect snowfall as well. But even so, 150% more than average is a good chunk of snow.
Yeah, that's a good chunk of snow. So there could be perhaps some flooding in the spring, at least in the north, northern part of the state. Roger in Blue Mounds, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I recently learned that NOAA has a uniformed officer's corps that apparently graduates from the Coast Guard Academy. And I was just wondering what they actually do.
So I didn't catch...
NOAA has an officer's corps that graduates every year, and he was wondering what they do.
Oh, so, yeah, so... Yeah, I would think, I'm not sure of this, but I would think that they support the Coast Guard by providing both weather predictions, but also lake conditions, as well as probably ocean conditions, but certainly lake conditions, Great Lake conditions.
So they'd be part of, they become part of NOAA in a way then?
Yeah, yeah. They would still be reporting as part of NOAA group, although they may be servicing on the Coast Guard ships.
I got it. Roger, does that answer your question?
Yeah, sort of. My understanding is that they are NOAA. They aren't the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is where they go to the academy at the Coast Guard, but they actually are a part of NOAA.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So they get their degrees from the Coast Guard Academy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think is in Kings Point, right? Kings Point, New York?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Not sure about that either. Maybe somebody else, maybe we have a NOAA officer listening in today, and we will find that out. Roger, stay listening. Appreciate it very much. Steve Ackerman with us, one of our weather guys. He does a lot of things around the campus, as a matter of fact. He's a vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW, but also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And John Martin will be joining us after our news break. And John, of course, a professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences. We're going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. You can call in, numbers 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Steve and John will be back with me right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys. Joining us now, John Martin, professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. John, good to see your smiling face.
Good to see you, Larry. Good to be here.
Steve Ackerman, we've already been talking with Steve for a bit now. He is vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. Also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in with your questions, number 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. And Jeff in Madison has a comment regarding, we had a question about the NOAA's officer corps just before our news break. Jeff, what's on your mind here?
Good afternoon. Just a quick follow-up. So I graduated from the Coast Guard Academy, which is New London, Connecticut, back in 76, and my son graduated in 2007. And to my knowledge, there weren't any NOAA officers, but I think where the confusion may have come is the Merchant Marine Academy is in Kings Point, and it would make sense that NOAA would get their officers from the Merchant Marine Academy. And I would speculate then that those officers would control the, you know, NOAA has some ships. So anyway, a little bit of follow-up.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate the call very much. Cool to see your son involved in that as well.
Yeah. It's a great service, Coast Guard.
All right. Yeah. Bye-bye. Thank you so much. Well, I'm glad to have that brought up. Mike in Cottage Grove has a question, so let's go there. Mike, hi.
Yeah, I got an observation from like 35 years ago. Without getting too specific, you could fly north until it turned south, and along the coastline, it was solid ice all the way up. And now my Coastie, and here's the Coast Guard again, my Coastie pals tell me that they have got to replace their World War II icebreakers with brand new icebreakers to keep a trade route open across the top of North America from Asia to Europe, because the ice is getting so thin, it's all opening up. Have you heard anything like that?
Hmm.
Yeah, definitely. As the ice cap, the ice sheet up on the Arctic Ocean shrinks, it's opening up a pathway so that you can almost circumvent the polar regions now. Not quite yet, but there is, I'll use the word concern as that opens up because of the environmental impact. Because, you know, it's a lot easier to go north to get from the west coast to the east coast of North America. It's a lot easier to go northward if you can than to go southward and go through the Panama Canal and then back up again. And so there's anticipation that there'll be a lot of shipping once that opens up, you know, more than, well, when it opens up, I don't know if it'll open it up on an annual for 365 days, but there'll definitely be seasons when that pathway opens up.
So that may be a good thing in that regard, I suppose, but the worry, the climate change worry is really there.
Right. It'll be the impact on the ecological systems.
Yeah. Mike, thank you so much for calling. Bob in northeast Wisconsin, near Lake Michigan, I think. What's on your mind?
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. I was wondering, it seems to me that we have been getting many, many, many more windy days. And not just windy, I mean really windy. Has something changed, or what's the scoop?
Yeah. John, any, get you involved here.
We keep hearing this, you know, anecdotally, and I keep on meaning to look up some statistics, and I keep forgetting. So there's three keeps there. This winter in particular, I would be surprised, depending on where you are in the state. The southern part of the state, we've had an absence of storms. I would say we've had probably fewer windy days in the southern part of the state this year, this winter, than we had in prior winters. But that also is anecdotal. I know, though, for a fact that quite a number of the weeks that we were waiting for something to happen down here, things were happening in the northern part of the state. So if you're near the peninsula or you're in the, you know, further north than that, it may well have been a windier year because there were a whole bunch of Alberta Clipper type storms that have kind of made their way southeastward across the northern part of our state, southern shore of Lake Michigan, Lake Superior. And so it's quite possible that this year was a little bit windier than normal. But I'm sorry, I don't have the stats in front of me, and haven't, even though repeated questions like this have prompted me to want to do that, I haven't done it. So it'd be an interesting thing to study.
Yeah, John, I emailed Ed Hopkins this morning. Because he had looked at this a few years, well, probably 5 or 6 years ago, to see if he's looked at it recently as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. Well, maybe we can report on that in March. That might be a good. Yeah. That might be. You know, March is the windy month. Typically,
you got to send all these jobs to the dean's office. That's the way to do it. Then they get done. And that's just Steve's proving it again. So
there you go. Ann in Brookfield sent us an email with two questions. Seems it's warmer in Milwaukee than elsewhere, and it cools the further west you go, especially at night. And, of course, in summer, it's the opposite. Milwaukee's the cool spot for much of the state. Is this accurately, and is global warming expected to change it?
That is accurate, and that's a function of the heat capacity of water, specific heat of water. It really takes forever to warm up, so the summertime, you don't get quite the heating on a warm day that you would here in Madison. And in the wintertime, it takes forever to cool down. So you get a little bit of an insulation. So that is definitely true. And that difference between Madison and Milwaukee, no matter what the future climate holds in store, will probably carry through because water, the liquid water substance is so strongly, you know, playing a role in that particular difference.
Her second question had to do with the sunshine. Does Lake Michigan affect cloud cover?
Oh, yeah, definitely, particularly when it's not frozen, because then, you know, what do you get a cloud form is when you have water vapor in the atmosphere and you have lifting motions. And so anytime you're over a large body of water, if you have the right atmospheric forcing, lifting motions, then that humidity is going to go up and a cloud will eventually form. Particularly during the wintertime when you get that cold air.
Yeah,
that
comes
yeah, over, yeah. Then it's really
Great Lakes, it really generates a lot of low-level clouds.
Robert from McFarland sent an email including some photos of what he believes is to be sun dogs. And Steve, I think you've seen them. Robert says they saw a small vertical rainbow. It was pretty cold, with wispy clouds passing over. Also on February 23rd at about 7:45 in the morning, he noticed a similar reflection. Sunglasses greatly reduced the colors. Do these occur when it's not cold out? What are the ideal conditions and times for this?
Oh, yeah, they can occur at any time. The photo that he sent is really unique, I think, because except where that sun dog is, and that is, it's like a little rainbow kind of feature, and it's right to the horizontal to the right side or the left side of the sun, and it moves up and down with the sun in a faithful manner that a dog would, which is why they call it a sun dog, because it faithfully follows the sun, its master. And yeah, you can get that at any time during the year. The thing that you really need is some thin cirrus clouds. So some clouds with ice crystals in them, not too thin, not too thick, so that you can get the appearance of the rainbow colors. If it gets too thick, it gets all washed out and you can't see anything.
Another email we received from a listener with a question about the severe weather number system. Why is it 1 to 5? Also, when it comes to sunrise and sunset, what's the horizon or measuring point that they use? John, do you want to jump in?
I don't really know the historical origin of 1 to 5. There's actually, for tornadoes, you go from F0 to F6, which is F0 is does a lot of damage to trees or something, and F6 is inconceivably strong. No storm has ever been designated that, but they leave it out there in case something comes along. But there's criteria for each of those different stages for the enhanced Fujita scale. I don't know anything more about its origin except that it was originated, I think, by Ted Fujita at the University of Chicago in the 50s and 60s. And he did after-the-fact surveys of tornado damage and started to build thresholds for how much stronger this storm had to be to take a house off of its foundation versus this one to put a tree on top of the roof of the house and so on. So they're structural, mechanical delineations that are based on empirical observation.
And the highest for a tornado, we've had F5s.
Yeah. As I say, that's the one that you hear one or two of them every year, and they leave out there the possibility for an F6 tornado, which I don't really know why they do that. Inconceivably strong would probably mean Wichita's there one day and the next day it's gone. I don't know what would be the operational criteria to invoke an F6.
Yeah. So. And the F5s, I think, man, I'm trying to think back. Barneveld, maybe some years back, that might have been an F5.
It was at least F4. It might have been F5. It could have been F5.
Yeah, anybody who was living there at the time probably felt like an F6 to them.
Yeah, what an event. Unbelievable event.
You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I was thinking back that a tsunami killed three people back in January after a volcano exploded. The volcano was it's called Hunga Tonga or something like that. Maybe mention that, because that eruption, I think NASA said it was more powerful than an atomic bomb.
Yeah, that was a huge eruption. And, you know, it was not only a huge eruption, but it was really captured well by satellite imagery around the globe. And because of that, we saw some really interesting features. I mean, you can imagine a big explosion like that is going to send a shockwave. And in the satellite imagery, because of the quality nowadays, you could actually see that shockwave moving out as it generated vertical motions and then would cause thin clouds to kind of propagate away from the explosion itself. And then there were that pressure wave was then observed at ground-based weather stations that were measuring pressure. They could also then see the pressure wave move around the globe at 700 miles per hour. I mean, it's
quite, yeah, that's amazing.
Amazing.
We felt it on this building. I mean, if you at the level of instruments, we didn't feel it ourselves, but it was recorded by instruments here. Yeah. Incredible.
Oh, and did that have any sort of local impact on the weather? I mean, local for that where it was.
It had local impact in the sense that, you know, a huge amount of ash fell in the area, and so that's going to change the albedo of the surface, which is going to cause it to warm up. It didn't have much or any sulfuric or SO2 in it, and that generally can lead to reductions in global temperatures if it gets up into the stratosphere and becomes sulfuric acid particles. We saw that with Pinatubo, but this didn't have that kind of chemistry involved with it, so we didn't see that. And lightning, I guess the other thing was lightning.
There was a lot of
lightning with these storms.
And why?
Eruptions.
Why is there so much lightning with it?
So, the lightning, whether it's in a cloud or in a forest fire or in a volcanic eruption, it's two different materials rubbing together. So in clouds, it's liquid drops versus ice crystals. For static electricity around our house, it's our rubber soles against rugs. And in an eruption like that, there's a lot of materials in there that just rub against each other, generate static electricity, builds up, and then it releases it by a bolt of lightning.
Well, we have some callers. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Jay in Fenimore, we'll go to you. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you doing? Great topic today, especially as we go into spring. I want to mention that I've been in a number of tornadoes in my life, actually in them, and they've gone over me. I'm lucky to be alive. But in Viola in 2005, there was an F2 tornado, and the thing that was significant about that was the cleanup was so fast, there was no FEMA aid. I'd like the guest to comment on that, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Comment
I missed
on
that last part. You said it was cleaned up really quickly.
It was cleaned up so quickly that there was no FEMA support or help. Local help cleaned it up so quickly that FEMA didn't have time to even step in.
I guess that is a danger. As John pointed out, it doesn't get classified as an F1, 2, 3, 4, or whatever until somebody goes in and looks at the damage. And it's based on that damage that they can determine what kind of strength it was. And so, people rapidly clear things up. I would imagine it's a weak one. Otherwise, if it's an F4 or something, they're not going to be able to quickly clean it up.
Yeah. And maybe the nature of the damage, where it was located, had a role to play in the rapidity of the cleanup too. But that is strange. But on the other hand, it makes me think, I don't really know how that process works. Once the natural disaster occurs, what's the time scale? What are the steps in the time frame whereby FEMA is called in or not? So that's an interesting question.
Courtney, my producer's reminding me I forgot to follow up on this second part of an emailed question that had to do with sunrise and sunset. What's the horizon or measuring point they use for sunrise and sunset?
Good question. I would say an astronomical type of thing. But if you read the newspaper, they often give two times, right? There's a sunrise, sunset, and then a skylight or what is it called?
Twilight, maybe?
Twilight.
Civil twilight, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's
earlier. And that's when the sun is probably below the horizon.
Yeah, I wonder about that. Maybe they do just, they just do measure it. Because every calendar, every year, the June 12th will be the same. So, maybe you just measure on a clear June 12th when the sun finally just disappears. No more individual rays are hitting your eye. And that's the time you note down that sunset and vice versa for sunrise. I don't know.
Well, I'm hesitating here because I know John is so enamored with the Farmer's Almanac, but...
Yes, I am,
but somebody's wondering about the accuracy of that. There's a question about the accuracy of the Farmer's Almanac.
Well, I encourage the wondering generally. That's a good thing. You should always wonder, but you should be prepared to have your illusions dispelled because The Farmer's Almanac is the least accurate vehicle for getting any sort of information about the weather, and it's a complete it's complete bunk. So, but it's entertaining, and so I don't criticize it any more than criticizing it scientifically. There's absolutely nothing scientific about the Farmer's Almanac. They do tend to recognize that December will be colder than June and so on. I'm joking here, but that's about it. That's about all you could take from that. And they even say, don't they even say, Steve, our forecasts come from a time-honored you know, recipe, which they don't divulge because they're petrified that someone might say this is bunk. And I'm saying it to you right now for free.
Yeah, at least we know how the groundhog does his forecast.
Yeah, right. You know, there's no other profession in our world, I think, that delivers such important information to such large numbers of people and yet gets displaced by a goofy book from the 18th century or a fuzzy little squirrel from Pennsylvania. Not right. It just ain't right.
Oh, man. Well, you know, in the first part of the show, I had a question, but Mike in Milwaukee's on with something. So let's go there. Mike, hi.
Yes, I hope it's worth mentioning, as long as March is coming up tomorrow, the March of 2012 had above average summer-like temperatures to the point that it fooled all of the fruit trees into blossoming, and then a cold snap in early April, I think, almost ruined most of the fruit crop.
Yeah.
And then also the February of 82 was entirely below zero, except for two or three times that it got up to zero.
In March of 1982, you're saying?
No, the February of 82.
Oh, February of 82.
It was way below normal, with below zero, except for a couple of times it got up to zero. And the March was way above normal of 2012.
Wow. Yeah.
So you had a hot...
Yeah.
March of 2012, yeah. We had, until that month, we had 4 days in Madison's history where the temperature was above 80 degrees at any point in March. We had four new inductees into that list in that 1 month of 2012. It was that unusual. That was exceptional. I think it probably depends on where you were in February of 1982 for the many days below zero. I don't know if that's true in Madison. Probably it isn't, but maybe in other parts of the northern tier of states, it might well be true.
Well, it's something that I have blotted out of my memory.
That was amazing.
Although not the 80-degree March weather. I haven't blotted that out.
No. We'll take that.
Yeah, I haven't blotted that out. We were talking about science with Bassam Shakashiri in the first 45 minutes of the show today. What research have you guys got? We only have a minute or so to talk about it, but what research is going on? John, I'll turn to you.
I'm thinking a lot about whether how to measure whether the jet streams at the tropopause level are getting wavier. It looks like they are. And then the next question, of course, a whole bunch of them perhaps, is why. I don't know why. I haven't even tried to begin to think about why in the research papers themselves. They just tried to introduce a method for doing it. So the next thing is trying to figure out why. And is there any ramifications for an increase in waviness in terms of storms and various things like that? Maybe particularly at the end of the winter or early spring.
So that's something you're working on.
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, on that happy note, I will thank you both for being with us. It's always so much fun to have you along. And we'll look forward to the last Monday in March when we see your smiling faces again. Thanks, John.
Thanks,
Steve.
Thanks, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, will be back. They always come the last Monday of the month, and they will be back. Both from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW, and Steve, also Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education. Tomorrow we talk about what it takes for athletes to succeed and also balance mental health. A Wisconsin sports psychiatrist joins the show to explain, and we'll talk about the upcoming basketball tournaments as well. Looking forward to our sports show. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.